The reason why I became interested in this topic started about a year ago. At the end of my second year of law school, I was studying for exams with my friend Sam Cohn. Sam grew up in the South in a small city, Greensboro, North Carolina. And I've always, ever since I became friends with him throughout the first 2 years of law school, I've always considered him in certain ways like the paradigmatic Jew. His family had been living in the South since literally the Civil War. They have traditions of hiding the Sifrei Torah from the Union soldiers. His father is the president of the local synagogue. And even he would tell me all these stories about growing up in public school, how people, you know, this, Greensboro is part of the Bible Belt. People would come over to him all the time asking him why he hasn't accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as a Savior. So I've always considered Sam to be like really like the paradigmatic Jew in a certain very deep way. And so we were sitting there studying, Sam, myself, and the third friend. And the third friend said jokingly, like, you know, it's nearing the end of law school, we're finishing up our second year. Once we start working, we're not going to have time to date or anything like that, so it's really time that you two get married. And so I said, okay, Sam, you know, in preparation for that, I'm going to have to find you a nice Jewish girl, because that's what we're all looking for. And Sam said, well, you know, Shmuel, first of all, the Jews in New York don't consider me Jewish, because everyone knows, you know, that there are no Jews in North Carolina. And you wouldn't consider me Jewish, because my mother isn't Jewish. And I didn't know that before, but it was shocking. It was very shocking to me. Why was it shocking? Because, as I said before, in many ways I considered Sam to be the paradigmatic Jew, someone who, in the face, in a hostile society, not in New York where there are many Jews and it's easy to be Jewish, but in a society where it's not easy to be a Jew, he always proudly wore his Jewish identity on his sleeve. Despite that, the halakha does not consider him a Jew. The halakha would quicker consider someone who was born of a Jewish mother Jewish, even if they did not have any Jewish identity, did not affiliate, did not identify, did not anything. And you could say, okay, well, why is this important? You know, it's just a matter of citizenship. It's just a matter of legal status. This doesn't really affect, or doesn't have to affect, your relationship with him. And in some senses, that's correct. But it's not correct in the following sense. Citizenship, any citizenship, whether a U.S. citizenship, any legal status, carries with it certain rights and responsibilities. Aside from those rights and responsibilities, halacha has a series of laws and a series of laws that inform the halachic Jew, the Jew that is following halacha, on how to relate to someone who does not have that same status, i.e. a non-Jew. And thus, for instance, if Sam wanted to invite me over for a meal, I wouldn't be able to eat at his house, even if everything was kosher, because it would be bishul akum. And if I wanted to have him over at my house, I'd have to be really concerned about the wine that would be served because of stam yenam. And, you know, if he wanted to marry my sister, or if my children wanted to marry his children, none of those things could happen because he wasn't considered a Jew. And the point of this class is not going to be to argue that in some way the halacha does consider him a Jew. It's pretty clear, you know, in the way that the halacha developed, that patrilineal descent, and if you only have a Jewish father and not a Jewish mother, does not make one, within the eyes of the halacha, a Jew. But it sparked my interest, that it was just completely jarring to me, that someone who, in my mind, was so completely, totally Jewish, and made sacrifices for his Jewishness, would not be considered a Jew, while people who literally do nothing, who are just Jewish simply by dint of birth, the halakha does consider them a Jew with all the rights and privileges attendant to that status. And so, this sparked my interest. What does it mean a Jew? What does the halakha consider to be the constitutive, the primary, the central elements of what it means to be a Jew? And I think the halakha discusses this in two places. It discusses it when people are coming into the community, when people are converting, and also discusses it when people are leaving the community, when people are converting out of Judaism into another faith. And I hope that in studying these two rites, the rite of Giyur, the rite of conversion, and of Shmat, how we treat an apostate, someone who leaves the religion, we can develop in some sense maybe one model, maybe different models of what it means to be a Jew. at least in the eyes within the framework of halakha. And just to emphasize, this class is not, although we're going to be dealing primarily with halakhic texts, this class, the goal here is not to a comprehensive survey of the laws of Geirut, and it's not going to be like a practical class. Like, we're not going to form at the end of this, at the end of these couple of classes, form a little bet in the gear and start converting people on West End Avenue. Although, you know, we could make a lot of money doing so, but it's for another time. The goal here is not that. We're going to absolutely deal with the halakha l'ma'asa, the black letter law, but what I'm more interested in this class, in these series of classes, is looking at the values that are underlying these halakhic texts. There's going to be text, there's going to be analysis, but there are going to be very clear values that emerge from these texts, and that's really what I'm interested in. What modes of Jewishness and what types of Jewish identity are being expressed in the process of someone becoming a Jew and in the process of someone leaving a community? So that's a kind of a broad overview for what we're going to be doing. Just a couple of things in terms of how we're going to run the class. I hope to have like a little bit of chavruta time in each class to prepare a couple of the central texts that will be discussed in all of the later sources. Aside from that, if there are any questions, I love questions. I want it to be super participatory. And again, I hope to learn all of you, all of your names, and get to know you a little bit better. The first source that we start off with is on page one, source number one. This is the locus classicus. This is the starting point for all discussions of the laws of Geirus. Is this Gemara in Yevamot on 47a. And what this does, this is a narrative describing how someone converts from the time that they first approach, from the time that the convert first approaches the Beit Din or whoever it is, expressing an interest in converting, all through the very end when he becomes a full Jew. So this is, I think that I want to start with this text because it gives us a broad overview of the entire conversion process, and then in the next two classes we're going to zero in on certain elements of that process. Does anyone want to read source number one? English? Okay, I'm going to start calling on people. Yes, please, take it away. What's your name?
Matthew?
Okay.
Tom Robert. In the Hebrew? Or
right. English, please.
All right. Our rabbis taught, if a prospective proselyte comes to undergo Giyur in the present era, we say to him, what did you see that made you come to seek conversion? Do you not know that nowadays the Jewish people are afflicted, oppressed, downtrodden, and harassed, and that hardships come upon them? If he responds, I know and I am unworthy, we accept him immediately. And we inform him of some minor commandments and some major commandments. And we inform him of the sin, the neglect of the commandments, the eating of forgotten sheep, of the corner and of the poor man's tithe. And we inform him of the punishment for the transgression of the commandments. We say to him, be aware that before you reach this situation, if you ate
chalev, which is like a type of fat, or like suet,
chalev, you are not punishable by karet. If you profane the Sabbath, and you were not punishable by stone, but now, if you eat suet, and you will be punished by karet, and if you profane the Sabbath, you will be punished by stoning. Just as we inform him of the punishments for the commandments, we inform him of the rewards of observance. We say to him, know that the world to come is not made except for the righteous. And, in the present era, the Jewish people cannot receive an abundance of good or an abundance of calamity. We do not overwhelm him, nor are we strict with him. Once he accepts Kibel, we circumcise him immediately. Once he is healed, we immerse him immediately. And two rabbinic scholars stand over him and inform him of some minor commandments and some major commandments. Once he is immersed and comes up, he is like a Jew in every respect. In the case of a woman, women seat her in the water up to her neck, and two rabbinic scholars stand outside and inform her of some of the minor commandments and some of the major commandments. The same procedure applies to a proselyte and to an emancipated slave.
Okay, thanks. So what we see here is the basic structure, and we're going to come back to the spraita time and time again, because in here, every major debate about Geirus basically starts with the spraita and certain interpretations of sections within it. But just to broadly go over what we saw here, there seems to be a couple basic steps in conversion. The first is, we want to make sure we want to find out what his motivations are, right? And we want to warn him what he's getting himself into. So we tell him, don't you know, the Jews are oppressed, they're downtrodden. Then we warn him a little bit about the kind of the religious obligations that he's going to undergo, that there are going to be all these strictures that he wasn't previously bound by. And then finally, there's Mila, there's circumcision, and Tefillah, when he immerses in a mikvah. Mila and Tefillah are relatively uncontroversial within like the corpus of conversion, within the corpus of Gerut. Everyone agrees that you need to do them. No one really has a problem with doing them. And so I'm not going to really spend so much time discussing them in this class. The two components that I'm going to spend a little bit more time on is first the motivations of the convert. When a convert first comes to join the community, convert, to what degree does he need to obligate or accept upon himself, bind himself to normative practice of Jewish law? Is that necessary? And if it is necessary, to what degree? So within today's class, we're going to be dealing with the first question, really like the first step within the conversion process. Someone comes to convert and you want to know, why are you doing this? In the next 15 or so minutes, I want people to pair up with Chavrutas and go through up through source number 4. So sources 2, 3, and 4. And what these are different Talmudic passages. Or actually, there's one from the Sefer Gerim, which is quasi-Talmudic. I want you to go through these three passages with the Chavrusa, and I want you to figure out what that passage is saying about the necessary motivations for a convert. I want to make 2 points. Source number 4... Source number 2 actually had 3 distinct positions. So there's not one position articulated in source number 2, but there's going to be 3 distinct positions. And just to start you off, to give you a sense of what I want, let me briefly discuss the passage that we just saw. In source number 1, right, when the convert first comes to join the, you know, to start the process of conversion, the only thing that we ask him is, don't you know that the Jewish people are oppressed, that they're downtrodden, they are afflicted, oppressed, downtrodden, and harassed. And so it seems from this source that the only kind of motivation necessary for a convert is that he share in the plight of the Jewish people, right? Ameich ami, that your nation is my nation, and the troubles that you go through will be my troubles. We don't ask him whether, you know, he loves God. We don't ask him whether he's really doing this because he hears that Jews are rich and powerful and smart, and he wants to join a rich, powerful, smart community. The only thing that we ask him is, are you willing to suffer with the Jews, you know, when they're suffering? So in the next 15 minutes or so, pair up a chavruta, go through these next 3 sources, and I will be calling on people afterwards to discuss that. All right, so we just saw, hopefully, 3 sources relating to the motivations. When someone wants to join the Jewish community, when someone wants to convert, we just saw 3 sources discussing how to approach those motivations. The first source is the Gemara in Yevamos on Chaf Dalet on the Bet, 24b. And there are 3 basic positions outlined here. Does anyone want to try to articulate 1, 2, or all 3 of them? Okay, I'm going to start calling on people. This is the tradition in law school. This is how things are done, that we're given cases to prepare, and then the teacher calls on you, and if you don't know it, he embarrasses you, and people learn. Yes. So now we're discussing the source number 2, Yevamot 24b. What do you think are some of the opinions expressed here about a convert's motivation?
There's a set of suspect motivations, and one opinion says they're probably not a proper proselyte, but if it's in a marriage or something else that intervenes, then after the fact we regard them as a proper proselyte.
Okay.
The next opinion is they're always a proper proselyte, and the third opinion is they're never a proper proselyte.
Absolutely, that's fantastic. Absolutely. All three positions are captured in there. So the crux of this Gemara is a debate between, the Psak of Rabbi Nechemya, who says, let's just go over it inside. Give me a second. It's kind of at the end of, right at the beginning of source number 2, Echad Isha Niskayel Shem Isha, someone who's getting married for this, converting for the sake of a woman, Echad Isha Shem Niskayel Shem Ish, someone who's converting for the sake of a man, V'chein Mi Shem Niskayel Shulchan Malachim, someone who's converting to get a place of prestige or honor, Shem Avdei Shlomo, to be one of the servants of Solomon, again, a position of honor, Enam Gerim, Dibri Rabbi Nechemya, Shahaya Rabbi Nechemya Omer, Rabbi Nechemya said, Echad Geir Arayot, these were people who converted out of fear that they'd be eaten by lions. This is a story in the Bible. Echad Geir Chalomot, if you had a bad dream and you thought converting to Judaism would save you from the consequences of that. Echad Geir Mordechai Be'Esther, it says at the end of Megillat Esther that there were many people, the Jews were ascendants again, and many people were afraid of the Jews, and so there were many people who converted. Enam Geirim, Enam Geirim. Right, that's the psak of Rabbi Nechemya, that they are not, we don't accept our converts. If you have kind of ulterior motives for converting, we don't accept you. And then we have the tradition, Amar Bishlach Bar Shmuel Bar Marta, Mishmei Derav, we have that second opinion that says, no, Halacha Kedibri Ha'omer Kulam Geirim Heim. Right, and then we have the position that says, no, they are converts, it is a valid conversion. And then at the very end, we have the bright Tanu Rabbanan, Ein Mekablam Gerim, Mimod HaMashiach, Yotzebo, Lo Kiblu Gerim, Lo Bimei David, Lo Bimei Shlomo. That we didn't accept converts. Here, just be careful about language. What does it say? It says, Lo Kiblu, we did not accept them. Right? We did not accept converts during the days of David and Shlomo. The implication being that if somehow they were converted, and we'll discuss how that might come to be, then the conversion is valid. You always have to be careful, very precise about the language. When the Talmud says lo kiblu, it means that the court, the beit din that is doing the conversion, shouldn't accept them as an initial matter, l'chatchila. But post facto, if somehow they've already been converted, the conversion is valid. Rabbi Nechemya would say no, even post facto, it's no good. And then, right at the beginning of the Gemara, the implication is that it's fine, right? Hageiros miyahavia. Someone who converted for the sake of marriage, it's a valid geiros, and the only reason why the Gemara kind of doesn't like it here is because there are all kinds of rumors going about this person living with this non-Jew. So here you have three basic positions in the Gemara. The first saying, it's okay, even improper motivations are ulterior motives. Let's not call them improper, but ulterior motives are fine. Even as an initial matter, l'chatzfila. The second opinion saying no, only b'diavad, after the fact, is ulterior motives acceptable? And the third position, that of Rabbi Nechemya, saying no, if you have ulterior motives in coming to join the Jewish community through conversion, it's not a valid geirah. Excellent, thank you very much. Let's go on to source number 3. Source number 3 is from Mesechet Geirah. Mesechet Geirah is what we call like the Mesechtot Ketanot. They contain Talmudic material, but they were compiled at a later date. Mesechet Geirim was compiled at some point during the Gaonic era, but a lot of the material in there is earlier. What is the chidush? What is Mesechet Geirim saying that we didn't see in the previous source? Right. The first thing it says, it starts off Kalam Iskayar L'Shem Isha, someone who's converting for a woman, etc., etc., Enam Geirim. So we already saw that in the position of Rabbi Nechemya. It's saying something more. There's an additional thing here. There's an additional requirement. In Mesechet Geirim. Does anyone want to venture a guess what that is? Just read the source. It's saying, the first thing is, yes.
Shem Shemayim.
Absolutely. First of all, what's your name?
Talia.
What do you mean by that? Elaborate.
Well, at the end it says that someone has to undergo it, the Shem Shemayim, in order to be a proper Geir. So,
can you just read the text out loud?
Yes. V'chol she'ino mitzgayer l'shem Shemayim eino Geir, and whoever does not undergo conversion for the sake of heaven is not a proselyte.
Okay, so this seems to be something more. Absolutely. Thank you, Talia. This seems to be something more than what Rabbi Nechemya is saying. Rabbi Nechemya was just saying that if you have ulterior motives, it's not a valid Geiros. And here, you don't just need a lack of ulterior motives, you need a positive, like affirmative motivation, and that motivation is Shem Shemayim. We're going to leave that, like, it could be literally translated as it needs to be for the sake of heaven. What the implications of that are, we're going to get to later on in this class. But this is, I guess, Mesechet Geirim is like the most extreme source in terms of motivation. That not only is ulterior motives invalidating the conversion, but you also need positive religious motives in order to convert. Let's now go to source number four. Source number four tells us a story. Anyone want to say over the story and what rule we might derive from that story? Did people not get the source number four? Who got the source number four? Wait. Do you want to?
Sure.
Thanks. What's your name?
I'm Sarah.
Sarah.
I didn't volunteer immediately
because
we were a little unclear what the
conclusion
was.
Okay. Well, we'll discuss it.
But there is a certain man who hears about a certain prostitute, and he sees her money, and he goes into her, and when he's going to get what he paid for, he sees blasphemy in the face, and he remembers that God judges and rewards, and leaves, and she is shocked and asks why he rejects her, and tells her about the Sisi, and she is like, so this is what we're going to say about. Either she's so impressed with this religion that she would believe in it so strongly as to leave her, or she's so impressed with him as
Man
that she goes to his rabbi in the town where he learns Torah and asks to be a ger. And he says,
He says, right on. So I think you picked on an ambiguity that is key, meaning the question is, why does she want to marry him? Does she want to marry him because she was impressed by his kind of religious zeal, and we could almost say that is like, you know, a motivation, l'shem shamayim, or just because he was a really swell guy? I think at the very least we can say that there was at least mixed motivations here. It would be hard to say that it was simply the religious zeal that motivated her to go sell all her assets and convert in order to marry him. At the very least we can say that what this source tells us, the source number four tells us, is that when there are mixed motivations, right, when you think the guy is really swell and Judaism ain't that bad either, that is valid. And is this valid after the fact or even... even beforehand, even l'chatchila, right? She goes to Rabbi and Rabbi, who was it? Rabbi Chia. She goes to Rabbi Chia, and Rabbi Chia says, absolutely, go enjoy your acquisition. So I think what this source certainly tells us is that when there are mixed motivations in conversion, even as a l'chatchila matter, even initially we'll accept them for conversion, and I think a plausible reading of this source is it's not that there's mixed motivations, but she thought he was a swell guy. I think that's also a plausible reading of this source. And so even conversion for the sake of marriage, even as an initial matter, is fine. Let's just summarize the positions in the Talmud, and then we'll start getting into how the Rishonim reconcile all these different sources. So on, let's just go kind of from one extreme to the other. So on one extreme, we had the source in the Sechet Girim that said that it needed to be, conversion needed to be l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. And any convert that didn't intend for the sake of heaven, the conversion is not valid. One step over, we had the position of Rabbi Nechemiah. He said, whenever there's ulterior motives, and that could be for marriage, it could be for money, it could be for prestige, anything like that is not a valid conversion. Ulterior motives invalidate a conversion. We had, now we have a couple of middle positions that say that ulterior motives don't invalidate a as an initial matter. We should not accept converts who have ulterior motives, but ultimately, kulam gerim heim, ultimately the conversion is valid. And then we have maybe the story from Menachot, this last story of the prostitute saying that conversion for marriage, there might or might not be mixed motivations, but conversion for marriage is okay, even l'chatchila, even as an initial matter. So now we have this whole broad array of opinions out there in the Talmud, and let's now go to see how the Rishonim, how the medieval commentators deal with that. So let's go to source number, page number 3, source number 5. It's the Tur in Yoredeah 268, which is where all the laws of Gerut are discussed. Would anyone like to read it? Yes.
I don't get how, like in the Mishnah itself, it doesn't seem like there is any problem with the conversion of the Gentile. The only problem is it limits the marrying options of the Jews.
Which Mishnah?
There are some in common values.
Right. I agree. I agree. I mean, I think it's right.
So, like then, that would go with the most lenient position?
I would think so, yes. Except that the Mishnah, or at least the Gemara's interpretation of the Mishnah, is that, you know, there's still some kind of rumors floating around, but maybe we'll only say this when they're living together beforehand. But you're right.
That's like wacky to think how they, where they took the Mishnah.
Okay, you're right. I think from the Mishnah it is fair to argue that the Mishnah also represents this kind of extreme that conversion for the sake of marriage is fine even as an initial matter.
Yeah, and that's the implication the Gemara takes out of it. And then it brings the contradiction from the strict opinion.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, let's go to source number 5. Would anyone like to read? Ms. Berger, do you have a question?
I can read.
Oh, thank you.
Yish nitzgayer, b'shem isha, a man that converts for the sake of a woman. The achat isha shnitzgera, b'shem ish, and a woman who converts for the sake of a man. Yish nitzgayer, l'shem shulchan lachem, or someone who converts for the sake of presence at a royal table. The achad garei arayot, and someone who converts for not to be eaten by lions, v'chalamot, and bad dreams.
They are all good gerim. And so which position does the Torah seem to be articulating?
Most leaning
position. The most leaning position. Kulam gerim, it's okay. He doesn't make any distinction between post facto and ab initio. It's all okay. So those are fancy words for l'chatzchila and b'diavad. Post facto means after the fact, which is kind of b'diavad, and l'chatzchila, which is before the fact, the legal term for it is ab initio. But just so you know. Next we're going to look at, fine, so we have the Torah on one extreme, now we're going to look at the Rambam. The Rambam's a little bit of a more nuanced position. Sarah, do you want to read it and take it in English?
Sure.
It's a bit long.
The proper procedure when a man or a woman comes forth with the intention of becoming a proselyte is to investigate. Perchance he comes to enter the religion in order to gain money or to qualify for a position of authority. In the case of a man, they check if, perchance, he has cast his eye upon an Israelite woman. In the case of a woman, they check if she has cast her eye upon one of the youths of Israel. If no such motive is found in them, if they accept and do not withdraw, and it is evident that they come out of love, they should be accepted. A proselyte whose motives were not investigated.
Okay, stop. What does the Rambam say as an initial matter? L'chatkila, what does the Rambam ask? What's the Rambam's requirement for l'chatkila? That we investigate into their motives, and what happens? And what happens if improper motives are found?
Then they are not accepted.
Okay, very good. But let's go on now to halacha 17.
A proselyte whose motives were not investigated but was circumcised and immersed in the presence of 3 laymen is a proselyte. Even if it becomes known that he became a proselyte for some ulterior motive, he has exited from the Gentile collective because he was circumcised and immersed. However, he should be regarded with reservation until his righteousness becomes apparent. Even if he once again worships idols, he is as an apostate Israelite, whose betrothed is valid, and we are commanded to return his lost property to him. Because he immersed, he is an Israelite.
Okay, so now what does the Rambam say to Diabat after the fact? If he, if we didn't investigate into his motivations, what's the law? Is it a valid conversion? Absolutely. The Rambam adds one little twist there. He says, Choshishim lo, we're concerned for him. But this doesn't fundamentally affect. The Rambam himself emphasizes this, that although someone who enters the community with improper motives, we're a little bit suspicious of him, Choshishim lo, but ultimately he affirms that his Jewish status is not in question. We consider him a Meshumar Yisrael, an apostate Jew, a sinful Jew. And the way the Rambam says, the way the Rambam emphasizes this, is that we return his lost objects to him, which is not something we're commanded to do to someone who isn't Jewish. Although it's a very, very good thing to do, and we should do it. Yes, question.
I was wondering what you think the practical ramifications might be for the Chosh Hashem.
Okay, so Chosh, the practical ramifications.
It could sort of be that, he thinks you apply kind of strict things to this person, and to them as Jews, they get punished for things, or when it comes to property, they get it back. But the idea of
Choshishim,
would that mean?
Okay, Choshishim just means basically that in terms we'll tell our kids not to marry his kids, but not that they're forbidden to do so. It's a concept that comes up in the Parak of Asar Yuchsin and Kiddushin, where there are people who are certainly halachically Jewish, but we don't love their lineage. So, we're going to be a little bit hesitant. But it's clear that it doesn't affect their fundamental legal status as Jews. Yes.
Isn't that horrible?
Yeah.
Well, It's a hard, well, okay, so here's the thing. It's not, it's a horrible stigma, only in as much as Rambam doesn't say, like, this is a permanent stigma. We only treat him with suspicion until it's clear what his motivations are. If he comes and joins the community and is a great full-fledged member of the community, then we'll absolutely treat him with no suspicion. But if he's coming in with improper motivations and then really, like, lives up to that, you know, that inauspicious start,
then you can see what else.
Yeah.
Exactly. You don't. How do you put someone in this sort of limbo area?
Well, it's, again, because fundamentally, legally,
yeah,
he's not at all in a limbo area. Because fundamentally, legally, his kiddushin are kiddushin. You return his lost objects. He's a full Jew legally. This is just kind of like a communal, like, takana, whatever you want to call it. It has no binding legal status.
It's exactly what usually Menachem Yehuda. Like,
right, okay.
Like
it does, there is a little bit of tension here.
We should do exactly what we usually try not to.
Right, okay.
As much as we can.
I can see that point. Let's note it and move on, and maybe we'll get back to it later. Source number 7, I'm just going to discuss outside. Source number 7 is the Tosfot in Yevamot, and the Tosfot presents a contradiction. Because on the one hand, we have a Gemara. You can kind of follow the English if you want. I'm just going to summarize it. We have a Gemara that says that that during the times of David and Shlomo, there were something like 150,000 people who converted. And on the other hand, we saw in our Gemara that we just learned that we made David and Shlomo, we didn't accept Gerim. So how is it that there were 150,000 converts when we don't accept Gerim? And they also, Tosfot was also bothered by the Gemara and Menachot that we saw, where there was someone marrying for the sake of marriage. They were bothered by the contradiction, it seems, between these two Gemaros. So Tosos presents two answers that played out in later sources. The first answer is, in terms of the contradiction between our Gemara, which said that we didn't accept Gerim in the times of David and Shlomo, and the other Gemara that said there were 150,000 converts in those times, it says, Tosos' answer is that the court didn't accept it, but these people converted themselves. And we're not really sure, I mean, we'll have to clarify what that means, because in general you need a court to affect the conversion, so it might mean that it's a court of laymen. Okay, we'll get to that, that's one answer. The second answer, Tosfos again asks a question from the Gemara that we saw in Menachot, discussing the prostitute who married for marriage, and how could Rabbi Chiya do this? We shouldn't, you know, this shouldn't be done as an initial matter, l'chadchila. And Tosfot's answer is that Rabbi Chiya knew that sofo l'shem shamayim, that ultimately she would have the good intentions, and so therefore, even though now it seemed like she was converting for marriage, since like the court has some discretion to divine what the real motivations of the converts are, what the convert is, even if on the surface it appears like there are ulterior motives, therefore the conversion was valid. So the two principles that we'll take out of Tosfot is, one, that the court has discretion to look beyond the surface, and number two, the second principle that we're going to take out of Tosfot is that sometimes if a formal, like, duly recognized and duly organized bezdin can't do the conversion, sometimes we'll allow for kind of more shady conversions by laymen, by court of laymen, by, you know, bati din shel hadyotot is what it's called. Okay, so we have the Rambam and Tosfot as kind of middle position, saying as l'chadchila, as an initial matter, we should not convert people with ulterior motives, but you know, ultimately the conversion is valid, and there's a little bit of wiggle room. Let's look in source number 8, which is the Haggadah of Mordechai. We really don't know who he is. He's a Rishon, lived sometime in the 14th century in France. Would anyone like to read it? How about you? What's your name?
Avram,
would you like to read source number 8 in English, please?
All right. It seems to me that when people come to us for conversion, and we know that they have ulterior motivations, they should not be accepted. Tosafot asked, from the individual who asked Hillel to convert him so that he could become a high priest, and responded that Hillel knew the convert would ultimately act for the sake of heaven. It is clear from Tosafot that the Torah requires that there will be certainty that the convert will ultimately act for the sake of heaven.
Okay, stop. It is clear from Tosfot that the Torah requires that there will be certainty. Well, I don't know if Tosfot really said that, but let's go on. And although
this Talmudic ruling is they are all proselytes, what the Talmud means by this is that only later on, when we see that the proselytes' ways are upright, do we declare them to be Jewish, even though originally their intention was for marriage.
Okay, stop. So this is really important. The Haggadah of Mordechai here does a very nifty move. Let's just understand what he's doing, and then we're going to see how he's reinterpreting earlier sources. What the Haggadah Mordechai says is that the conversion is not valid right away, but when someone comes with ulterior motivations, but the conversion is only valid at a later point when we see, you know, that sofan hayal l'shem shamayim, that all, you know, that when they live the life and like a Jewishly committed life, and we see that ultimately at the end their motives were, their motivations were valid and righteous, only then is their conversion valid. Now this is very, very different than what Tosafot said. Tosafot said the conversion is valid right away, and the reason why it's okay to do it is because Rabbi Chiya said, oh, ultimately, you know, they'll be righteous. But Tosafot never ever said that the conversion right now at the moment wouldn't be valid. But that's what the Haggadah Mordechai is saying. He's taking Tosafot and like taking it one step further and saying that the conversion is not valid at this point, but it will only be valid once we see the ultimate righteousness of the convert's motivations.
So what would that mean, like, for somebody who had kids? Would their kids, like, also... What would be the status of them in the meantime?
A lot of ambiguity. Meaning, if they had kids before their motives were kind of made clear, you've had a lot of, like, quasi-Jews walking around.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult position, and we'll see whether it's really taken up in the sources. There's a reason why the Haggadah Mordechai is attracted to this position. There's a very basic problem that he's confronted with. Let's go on, continue reading.
This interpretation seems to be more plausible than to assume that the Amora might rule against Rabbi Nehemiah and the Braita, and against the Braita side with regard to the times of David and Solomon, which no town in dispute.
Stop. Okay, so the Haggadah Mordechai is bothered by a very basic interpretive problem, which is you have a Braita, right? Tanu Rabbanan, you have a Braita, a Tanaitic source, and then you also have the statement of Rabbi Nehemiah, who's also another Tana, saying the conversion's not valid. Einam gerim, right? And then we have the kind of the statement of the Amora citing the tradition that no, kulam gerim heim. And he's bothered by this kind of notion that the Amora would be disagreeing with Rabbi Nehemiah, who's a Tana. And therefore what he does is, what the Haggadah Mordechai says is, no. The Amora is not disagreeing with the Tana. The Amora, who said that kulam gerim heim, that the conversion is valid, is only saying it at a later point when we see that their motivations were pure. But if their motivations weren't pure, all would agree that the conversion is not valid. This is a super novel reading of both Tosfot and of the Gemara, and the Haggadah Mordechai himself admits to that. Just finish off, I have written
what seemed right to me, but I have not learned this from my teachers, and you should not rely on my personal understanding.
So he himself underscores the very novelty of his position and kind of how, you know, what an innovative read of the sources it is. So just to let's go on. We have one more source, the Shulchan Aruch. We could do this. I'll read it super quickly. When a person comes forth with the intention of becoming a proselyte, they should investigate. Perchance he came to enter the religion in order to gain money. In the case of a man, they check if he wanted to get married. Blah blah blah. If no such motive is found in them, they should be accepted. If his motives were not investigated, but was circumcised and immersed in the presence of three laymen, his conversion is valid, even if it became known that he became a proselyte for some ulterior motive. He has exited. Turn the page. I don't know which way. We're now on top of page 5. He has exited the Gentile collective because he was circumcised and immersed. However, he should be regarded with reservation until his righteousness becomes apparent. This is basically a quote of the Rambam, and That's the codified halacha. So to summarize, the same way that we had three positions among in the Talmud, we have these same three basic positions playing out in the Rishonim. On the one hand, you have the Tur, who's saying its ulterior motives are completely okay, even l'chatchila. You have the Rambam and Tosfot, who say ulterior motives are not okay l'chatchila, but b'diavad, after the fact, it's acceptable. And then you have the Haggadah Mordechai, who says no, ulterior, like, a conversion is not valid until it is clear that the person is doing something for the sake of heaven. And the Haggadah Mordechai position was a very novel read of some of the sources. And the Shulchan Aruch, Kedarko Bekodesh, follows the Rambam, basically quotes them verbatim. And that's the halacha that we have today. The halacha that we have today is found in the Shulchan Aruch, is that as an initial matter, we shouldn't accept people who are converting for marriage, but b'diavad, it's, you know, b'diavad, the conversion is valid. I want to make two points, because we're going to see crazy things happen in the modern period in terms of conversion. I don't know if we're going to get to all of it today, but I want to make two points. The first is that b'diavad doesn't only need to mean after the fact. There's a principle in halacha that says shahatcha k'diavad dami, right? That pressing situations can be considered legally like after the fact. And therefore, even if, let's say, someone has been civilly married, and they come to a rabbi now, and they want the rabbi to convert them, we might consider that a b'diavad situation, even though it's before the conversion. Because there's this kind of shah hatach, there's exigent circumstances, there's pressing need, we would consider that perhaps a b'diavad situation where we'd be willing to do the conversion. And like the only instance, I guess, where we would say, no, we won't do the conversion, is if someone comes to you and says, you know, should I start dating non-Jews, and then you'll just convert them. At that point, we should say, no, you know, l'chatchila, this is not something that we want you to be doing unless they're converting, you know, not because they met you. The second point that we're going to see, I guess, in the next class, is what's the definition of Shem Shemayim? Once we have the halakha canonized that says, as a l'chatchila matter, we need people to be have no ulterior motives, and it should be l'shem shamayim. A lot of the play among the achronim and the different shutim that we're going to see is going to be within the definition of shem shamayim. What does shem shamayim mean? Does it mean that you need to be inspired by religious zealotry and you really love God and want to do all that? Or there might be other definitions of shem shamayim. They get really interesting. Maybe nationalistic motivations are going to be sufficient. Maybe mixed motivations will be sufficient. Maybe a clear lack of ulterior motivations will be sufficient. We're going to see a number of definitions of Shem Shamayim in the you know, in the modern responsa that, you know, that's where like the wiggle room now is within the halacha. Once the Shulchan Aruch codified the position of the Rambam, the wiggle room within the halacha is going to be by like creative reinterpretation of that phrase Shem Shamayim, which doesn't really happen until the modern era. I'm deciding, well, let's just talk for 2 minutes. I just want to set the stage for next class, and then we'll conclude. Ephraim Orbach, who is one of the Gdolei HaChokrim of the 20th century, one of the greatest Jewish scholars, the thing that he was fond of saying was that there were two seminal moments in halakha. The first was the destruction of Bayit Sheni, when there was this profound change from a Judaism that was focused around the worship in the Beit HaMikdash, right, to to diaspora Judaism. That was one profound change that happened, and you see that playing out in the Gemara. And the second profound change, he likes to say, is modernity. Halakha's response to modernity affected profound changes, not just in the details, but in the way that people think about halakha, in the way that poskim decide halakha, and that was just as seminal of a change as the destruction of Bayit Sheni. And we're going to see that really playing out in the contemporary responsa discussing the motivations of the ger, of the convert, in terms of what, you know, what we're willing to accept. Now, there were three, in terms of conversion, there were three fundamental changes that happened as a result of the emancipation. Three fundamental changes that really made Chuchot Geirut a very complex question. The first change that happened was that you had secular Jews. What does that mean? You had Jews who fully identified as Jewish, who lived within the Jewish community, but who did not feel bound by Torah and did not feel bound by mitzvot. First fundamental change. Second fundamental change, many of the restrictions that were placed on where Jews could live, on what trades Jews could practice in, were removed. Why is that fundamental? We'll get to in a second. The third fundamental change that happened was that most countries pre-emancipation had laws against intermarriage. Many of those laws were rescinded after the emancipation. And so what happened is as follows. You have these three factors combined, and you basically have a perfect storm. You have people who are secular, who are marrying non-Jews, who intend not to live observant lifestyles, but want to remain within the Jewish community. And as opposed to, let's say, pre-emancipation, when not just the Jewish community, but all communities were basically organized around like a religious identity. And so you had the Catholic community, and that would take care of all your social services. They would marry you, they would bury you, they would provide you with a host of social services. And the Jewish community was in charge of that. The Jewish community was your liaison. you know, to the state government. That was no longer the case post-emancipation. And that removed the one great threat that rabbis had against members of the community. Before the emancipation, if someone was misbehaving, someone was in Shomer Shabbos, they're like, we're going to throw you out of the community. And unless you were willing to convert to Catholicism, you were basically in limbo. You were basically stranded. I mean, that was a very popular threat. Chayrim back in the day was something that carried with it great and profound implications. If you didn't have a community to affiliate with, you couldn't conduct life within the state. You couldn't conduct life within the state. And after the emancipation, all of that was done away with. So again, what do we have, just setting the stage for next week? We have a situation where people are unobservant, people want to stay within the community, people are marrying non-Jews, and they plan on staying within the community, married to these people, and the questions confronting these rabbis are, do we convert them or not? And this is not only a question of how to deal with all the sources that preceded them, but it's also a very profound policy question of what's best for the Jewish community. And I guess when we take up next week, we will be going through these contemporary responsa, looking at the different approaches that were taken by poskim, by halachic decisors in the 19th and 20th centuries on how to deal with this issue. Any questions? No? Okay, great. Thank you very much.